Hello, I'm Jacob Kruger, and this is the Write Your Screenplay podcast. This week is going to be a very special episode. For those of you who don't know, every Thursday night, we have a free class called Thursday Night Writes. And our recent episode featured a guest from our faculty, Stephen Moulton, who we are happy to welcome back. And the content about the seven different forms of conflict and how to activate the inner antagonists of your character, I felt was so profound that I wanted to share it with our wider audience. So that's what today's podcast is. It is a recording of that Thursday Night Writes. There's a wonderful writing exercise at the end, so make sure to hang out all the way to the end and enjoy. Hello, everybody. We lost him for a couple years as he ran off to do a big project, and we are over the moon delighted to have Stephen back on our faculty. Steve is a former HBO and Showtime executive, Columbia Film School professor, Pulitzer nominee. He wrote a movie with Frank Pugliese of House of Cards. He's worked in television, novels, nonfiction, film, limited series. He even wrote an opera. You did a limited series, didn't you? Am I wrong about that?
Yes, it's true. I wrote two limited series for Showtime.
Yeah, he's an extremely lazy guy, Adam. He's also just one of the great human beings and a good friend. And we're just so lucky to have him back on our team, teaching ProTrack, mentoring students one-on-one on their projects. The topic that Stephen wanted to talk about was internal antagonists. So often when we're thinking about what are the opposing forces in our script, we think about the bad guy, we think about the obstacle, but we're going to talk today about internal obstacles, the things that get in the way of our characters on the inside, the things that get in the way of us on the inside. And Stephen, where do we want to start?
Part of the reason I really wanted to do this particular subject tonight is having walked the picket line in the last year, we're a little bit besieged by the notion somehow that machines will be able to replicate what we do. But as some great person had his sign picketing said, computer can't have childhood trauma. We are still human beings. And the fact that we do live and die, that we are shaping the world and we must still shape the world, requires us to go really deep as writers. That self-knowledge and the degree of self-knowledge that you can achieve is where you're going to find your voice.
Let's jump in.
What I did, Jake, was I pulled together various notes from talks I've done. I've been teaching for the last couple of years over at the French National Film School, doing a master class there. These were for producers. So they weren't people who were naturally thinking like writers, although they were storytellers of a kind. What I basically embarked on was a course that was built on the seven forms of conflict. We moved through those very deliberately, starting with the self versus the self. I think it'll at least give you a kind of compressed version of how I think about the internal antagonist. All of my writers here sitting here tonight all over the world know about there are seven forms of conflict. We forget them because they're so common and ubiquitous. The self versus the self versus another, another person, self versus society, the self versus technology versus nature versus supernature, or the self versus supernatural, and the self versus God or fate or destiny. So as you can see, the first three of these are present in nearly in almost all strong movies and stories. The last four are genres unto themselves, but they too often include those three forms, the self versus the self, the other, and the society within the movie about the self versus technology or et cetera. So they're ubiquitous and they flow into each other. But tonight, I just want to talk to you about the first one, the self versus the self.
Steve, let me jump in for a moment. I saw a couple of questions pop up in the chat. The first is Dr. Will doesn't know any of that. Great. That's the goal of this. Every week, we're teaching you something new. The next question is, what's the difference between supernatural and God? How would you describe that, Stephen?
That is a fantastic question. They're commonly broken out that way. I would say, for my money, the supernatural, inexplicable things that occur among us within the frame of this world, and not so much the individual in relationship to the cosmos itself, as you might see in something like Tree of Life, for example, but really in terms of some phenomenon that is surrounding them that is inexplicable by science and by the self versus nature, and yet occurs in the natural world, something like the sixth sense, for example.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Are they interacting with a ghost? Are they interacting with Godzilla? Are they interacting with the Terminator? Are they interacting with aliens? These are supernatural. These are not our world. Certainly inhabit the worlds of movies. We don't have any ghosts as far as we know at Thursday Night Rights tonight. But if one showed up, we would be in a supernatural situation. Whereas that God, fate, destiny, this is all of Greek drama. Not only just the wrestling with God, whatever your version of the creator is, but also the idea of hubris, the idea of fate, the idea, can you escape your fate or change your fate, or is your fate ascribed by somebody else? So a show like Westworld, for example.
Right. Yes.
Which is about the bicameral mind. We have self versus self. Do I actually have control over myself, or is it the voice whispering that has control of me? Do I actually have free will? We have the self versus self. We have self versus society in that show. We have self versus technology in that show. We have self versus nature in that show. We have self versus supernature in that show. And we even have, if you consider Anthony Hopkins the God character, we have self versus God in that show, right? One of the things I think is really interesting is thinking of these as a spectrum that you can play in rather than, oh, I have to do this or I have to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ben wants to know, is self versus self the same as self versus inertia?
If character's problem is inertia, if their single largest obstacle within them is inertia, that can be one of the internal antagonists. The internal antagonist is comprised of many aspects of a person. It's fascinating to look at movies about a passive protagonist. That's what you're talking about. It's somebody who simply can't make choices. And the reality of that is, as it is in life, if you don't make choices and you are suffering from inertia, gradually events take over and they make the choices for you. You have less and less agency. It is something that you see in something like A Serious Man. It's a retelling of the Book of Job. And every terrible thing that happens, happens, but he keeps trying to hold on to what is. He keeps trying not to change, even though change keeps being forced upon him. That's a short response to that question.
Gretchen wants to know, does self versus self include mind versus body?
It can, and a great example of that would be The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which is all about the loss of physical agency and how that man in his actual life had to face down every internal demon you can imagine just to go on living and just to find a way to communicate. The incapacity of the body forces all of his internal antagonists into the open.
Yeah, I love that. I do want to jump in on Alexander's question. Can one character have two conflicts? Anytime you ask, can this happen? Look to your own life experience. The answers to being an artist are not in me or Steve Moulton or any other wonderful guide. We're just guides. The answer is in you. And so you can ask yourself, does this happen in your life? Are you in conflict with two different kinds of forces? If you are, you could probably write a great story about it.
That's a critical reflex to always go back to yourself and your friends and your family. The internal antagonist, knowing who the multiple internal antagonists of your character are, gives the story its depth. It gives it its psychological and spiritual gravitas. Knowing it, the self versus the other gives the story its momentum. Eventually, there needs to be an other out there. And the third dimension, the self versus society, gives it its breadth. But you can name multiple movies where all three of those are moving together in some sort of wild, lugubrious sync. And that makes that movie more interesting because it has and momentum and breadth all at once.
These are doors you can look behind. And if you imagine your writing is a giant mansion, you don't have to open every door. But when things start to feel not fully realized, you can, Steve just gave you seven doors that you can now start to look behind and go, oh, does that open up my palate? Does that open up my mind? Does that open up the world of it? So Steve, what I'd love to do now is I'd love to get really deeper, like you wanted to before I interrupted you, into like, how do we think about this self versus self conflict?
You are absolutely right to start with yourself, with the extraordinary wealth of, you have an inner protagonist too. And you easily show that inner protagonist to people all the time because usually what your strengths are and where your confidence comes from, et cetera. But the internal antagonist in your own life is quite often either hidden because it's suppressed or it's something you don't even really understand and you've never really looked at. We have to have a personal philosophy. We have to look closely as writers. It's not enough to just say, I make up stories and I write them down and they're wonderful. You really need to become a student of psychology and spirituality and personal history and sexuality and all of those things in order to be a good writer. And you have to care about them. You have to care about your characters as if they're alive. But stories are not morally neutral little entertainments, as we all know. If I just cut to the chase here and go where I go and try to probe what my internal antagonists, not in my life particularly, but in my characters, generally that doesn't happen the first time around. Generally, in my process, I just throw everything at the wall. And it's very much like going to a party. And there are all these characters you in the first draft, you throw down on the page, and you know they're humans. So that you know they have secrets. You know they have unexamined aspects. You know, too, that they have varying degrees of self-knowledge, which is something for you to gradually understand about your characters. But you won't know what those are in the first draft. You're just laying them down because they quite often just appear to you. And, you know, when you're doing it right, as they say, they just come. I'm reminded of the fact that Bob Dylan wrote Like a Rolling Stone. And he said it was because he kept hearing this song that he couldn't find on the radio. So he basically wrote it. The song forced its way into existence through him. A story sometimes forces its way into existence through you. And then you go back and you rewrite the second verse, or you start to explore more deeply. What in the world? You just came out of your head. As you start to really try to bring to bear your questions of the character, it's the same as being in a new friendship or in a new romantic relationship or in proximity to somebody you don't want to know. You begin to try to find out what's hidden about them and where the threats might lie or where they undermine themselves. If you write, I write in self-defense against all the lesser aspects of humanity that are coming at me all the time, including the ones from inside me. And I also write because I love the best in us, basically. The self versus the self is the bedrock of all powerful characters. It's the generator of a whole lot of a story's subtext. A great deal of what subtext is what's not spoken. Where is that unspoken stuff coming from? It's in the stuff that the character is either repressing or doesn't even understand about themselves. And it's also, no surprise, it's the key to our personal wisdom as we age. To me, it's A Diving Bell and the Butterfly is a wonderful example of a movie that's driven first and foremost by the internal antagonist. Manchester by the Sea is almost entirely driven by the internal antagonist. But the great thing to know about it, one of them is, the internal antagonist is the hand grenade in the story. If you look at Butterfly or Manchester by the Sea, you'll see either of those. They're two masterpieces that burst out of the battle going on inside a person and smash into everything around them. And that's the story. Now, so if it's the fulcrum of self-knowledge, I'm going to glide through here to some things that I think will get closer to what you're asking, Jake.
Yeah, actually, can I slow you down? Because I want to jump in on something, which is something very practical. Because, Steve, you said something that's so smart, that your job as a writer is to find what is hidden about your characters. And this is so wise because I've worked with so many writers who feel like they're unable to start because they don't know everything yet. And a lot of them have been sent on these kind of wild goose chases where it's, okay, write a character bio where you are going to lay out all the aspects of your character's psychology. And what ends up happening, of course, is you get pop psychology 101 baloney. And then the writer just has no idea how to translate that because it's not even based on anything real. When you allow yourself that journey of going, I don't know, and that's okay. I'm actually beginning a relationship with this person and I'm learning them. What ends up happening is your audience walks the razor's edge with you.
Yes.
And that is a very compelling experience.
And it makes for much more exciting storytelling. When somebody comes up to me and says, I have this story in my head and I have all the themes worked out, I just say, find a story where you don't have the themes worked out. Find a story where you don't know where it's coming from, and it's forcing you to write it down just by going into that kind of gray zone of consciousness. Because I think a story that is a result of a writer's struggle with ideas and struggle with a hidden aspect of themselves is what makes a story rich and shocks the writer even as they go, because they found something they didn't really imagine they had as they came out of the gate.
So many writers have this vision that we must be like these master puppeteers. No. We're not puppeteers. We're observers. and discoverers, and there's an actual relationship that develops as you start to put your characters on the page.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Sometimes your characters come all at once impressionistically. Other times they will sneak out of themselves over time. Maybe we're afraid we might not be able to control them. We fear that we'll be judged for having them, or we just have no idea that they're there in the first place. In any case, they are down in those characters, and you may not know what their internal antagonist is until they simply just start to behave in a certain way. Your awareness of that part of people, that hidden part of people, is much more acute than you think. So you can let yourself write and understand that you're never going to know everything about the insides of that person, but gradually you're going to gain a sense of it. And they're going to surprise you until you begin to know why it is they did that. And once you have to analyze them along the way. The whole process is intuitive, logical, any creative process is. So it's critical that you give yourself a break and just let these things come into the open, but then really explore what in the world is going on underneath there. And quite often it will show itself if you just have faith in your own. You got to have faith in the fact that you're lost sometimes.
Yeah, part of really getting good at this craft is getting comfortable in the discomfort. As you put it together, that's where you find the compelling ideas that nobody else can find. That's where you find the compelling nuance of that character or the compelling choice. You find it. Yeah, and I think this is one of the purposes of screenwriting and of literature and of writing in general, is we take the chaos of life that feels like it's coming at you in this giant mush where it's like too much to even make sense of cause and effect. And we start to parse it apart and allow an audience and a character to deal really closely with one little piece. Right? To understand one little piece a little bit more closely, a little bit more strongly, with a little bit more depth. And the way that you actually do that is you have to learn how to do that for yourself, which is go, oh my God, I'm going to jump into this sea of chaos. And then I'm going to trust myself to swim. And I'm also going to develop the craft that I need, because we're talking very much about intuitive processes, but there's craft that you need to do it. If you don't know how to do the doggy paddle, it doesn't matter how wonderful the sea you're in, you're going to drown. We got to dip in, and then we got to start applying tools to start to make shape of it.
Absolutely. And I'm fond of referencing what was so different about Shakespeare in terms of all the other dramatists that have preceded him. And in one of the ways it's compressed by Harold Bloom is that Shakespeare was the first one to create something like 100 protagonists that had never been seen before, because initially people in the theater, men and women, were represented as aging and dying, but seldom really changing in the course of the story. But in his plays, characters develop instead of unfold because they reconceive themselves in the course of the story. And usually it's because they become aware of themselves. They either overhear themselves and change, or their encounters with people begins to reflect an aspect of them that they were not aware that they even had. That happens in your life sometimes. If you can ask yourself the question, who do I know? You know anybody who perpetually sabotages their closest relationships? Why do they do that? Now, initially, you can have a scene that comes out of your head of somebody sabotaging their relationships. But if that's part of them is important and you keep telling that same thing over and over again, it's boring. But you need to find some means by which in the story they start to, quote, overhear themselves and change. There are many ways in which that can manifest. It may be that finally there's a lover who, because there may be 100 reasons why they do that, but it may simply be a matter of they encounter someone who starts to foresee the fact that they're going to leave soon, and who begins to say, who says, why do you do that? Why are you sabotaging what's already good? And they begin to reflect upon themselves simply because of who they meet. How does that overhearing process start to happen? It could happen in your own life through conversations with others that eerily start to echo too many others in your life, through a history of making the same mistakes over and over, through being arrested or outed or a spiritual awakening, or blurting out a Freudian slip. I had a conversation a couple of years ago with a close friend of mine for many years. And I poured my guts out about issues and problems and this and that. And I stopped for his response. And he said, I would respond and I'd give you some advice but you never listened to mine, ever. I said, what? He said, never in our whole long friendship have you ever listened to my advice. So I'm not going to give it to you anymore. You better be sure. I started listening to my friends in a very different way after that, but it was a revelation.
I started to think about the bear and the end of that second season when he's in the refrigerator. And we have this wonderful moment where we are seeing himself, but he is not seeing himself yet. Or he is seeing like a false vision of himself. We're watching the character tell themselves a slightly different story of their own life, or a profoundly different story of their own life. And when you start to think in that way, writing becomes both more challenging and easier.
It's true.
Talk about it.
Yeah, somewhere I'm flashing on Phantom Thread and what happens in the middle of the sea change that happens in the middle of that movie, when the woman who has come into his life begins to understand him better than he understands himself.
Yeah.
And realize that there's a Munchausen by proxy kind of relationship developing there. And so that can also happen in a story where someone is so discerning that they decide they know how to mess with that person's internal antagonist and turn them against them without them ever really having to do much at all.
Yeah. Yes. And we all have those people in our lives, right?
Where,
that can help us connect to our internal protagonist or our internal antagonist, the person who makes you connect to your confidence, the person who makes you feel like you're not good enough, right? We all have these people that trigger our inner conflicts. Well, and in fact, one of the ways that you can actually use inner conflict is to go, okay, what's the inner conflict that is not yet expressed in this movie or this show or this book or this play?
Yeah.
And you can go, you can breathe life into it, right? And you can allow that the representation of that inner conflict to become a character, right? And that doesn't mean it's a bad character. If you have a character who is, I'm thinking, as good as it gets, if you're character is Jack Nicholson's character in that movie, you blow life into that little piece of him that wants to be a better person.
Yeah.
And you get Helen Hunt's character, and suddenly you stick those two together in a situation they can't get away from each other, and they're both going to be changed by each other. And those inner conflicts are going to, they can't help but get resolved or changed or blown up, and that starts to become part of the story that we are, that the characters telling themselves and the story we're telling.
Yeah, if you just double back for a minute to Manchester by the Sea and understand that his the most pronounced and vicious internal antagonist inside of him, the reason he's just like grabbing strangers off their bar stools and pummeling them in the face for no apparent reason. And it's a wonderful example of the audience going, why is he doing this? Why is he doing this? What they're asking is, what's driving this rage from within? And gradually she realized that he was too drunk to protect his own children from a terrible fire that consumed everyone in his family except his wife.
Yeah.
And it's not until he finally sees her on the street after she's long left him and suffering from the same paralyzing pain, if not the guilt, that she's able to help him tame this beast before it destroys him by trying to give him a little just moment of forgiveness, like move on, let it go. It's incredibly powerful. But you're exactly right, because the other characters who become the reflectors of those internal antagonists by which you bring them into the open can be good or bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Are you familiar with Augusto Boal's work at all, Stephen?
With who?
Augusto Boal.
No, I know of him, but I don't know his name.
Boal was an agitprop theater guy. He was traveling around South America, and he was teaching, getting people to rise up against their oppressive government through theater. And at one point, they had just finished the show. They had the guns in the air, and they're like, we will shed our blood. And the audience went crazy. And afterwards, a guy came up to me and said, I'm so happy you want to shed your blood, because we want to shed our blood with you. And Boal tries to explain that, no, we're actors. We don't, no one's shedding any blood. Like, these guns are not real guns. And the guy says, but it's okay. We have real guns. And we will give you the guns, and we will go shed our blood together.
And Boal goes, no, I think you really are not understanding this. It's just a show.
And the guy says, oh, I do understand. He says, when you say shed our blood, you don't mean shed our blood. You mean shed my blood. And you could see how this is a true story, right? But this is actually an example of an internal conflict that Boal's not even aware of, where suddenly Boal sees himself and he thought he was the good guy changing the world and realizes, oh my God, I'm not the good guy changing the world. I'm the good guy telling other people to make the sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And so he decides he will never tell anyone what to do ever again. Mm-hmm. And he creates this new form of theater called Theater of the Oppressed that changes the world so much that they throw him in prison. And when he finally gets out of prison, he flees to France. And in France, he finds out that the suicide rate is 10 times the suicide rate in South America. And he's like, how is this possible? In South America, the people are oppressed. And in France, they're free. And how is it possible that the French are killing themselves off? And he comes up with this idea that's related to what Sita's talking about, called the cop in the head. And his concept is in South America, and I'm sorry, I'm calling it South America. I just don't remember which country he was working in. But in South America, you see the cop. He's outside. He's a man versus man or man versus society kind of conflict. But in France, the cop has been internalized. The cop saying, no, you can't do that has become inside the head. And he created a new form of theater around this called the Rainbow of Desire, where he would actually allow people to deal with all of the antagonists and all of the allies that kind of existed in their own conscious on stage in a play. I should do a masterclass on him. He's one of the most fascinating people that I was fortunate enough to study with. You could see it's that same thing that Steve is talking about. It's like, we have all it. We don't maybe necessarily just have one internal conflict in our head. We have all these different characters that live inside of us. And some are our allies and some appear to be our enemies, but are actually our allies. And some are internalized cops from the outside that aren't even us. And there's this incredible power of cinema and television to actually allow us to make peace with those voices and wrestle with them and see them and take them out of the shadows and into the light.
Exactly. Yeah. Writers are some moral provocateurs, and it doesn't mean they're more moral than anybody else. They're the ones who are most beset by questions, right? Yeah. Trying to figure out why in the world we are the way we are. And it's so true that those internal antagonists that you might identify, I just try to identify them as, what are the obstacles to this character's intentions? If they think they have an intention, if they have an objective, which most characters need at some point or other, what gets in the way within them to prevent that objective? It doesn't mean that's necessarily a negative or evil, or it may very well be that they just need to come out, or it may very well be that their bloodlust is a result of really unresolved shit with their father, who, when he finally dies in the third act, gives them a sense of uplift that they never knew they needed. It is a wonderful dynamic. Boal, I have to go find out more about, because I've known his name forever, but we really are everyone. We are everyone. And we are capable of anything. And it's the matter of the choices we make for out of our better nature. And because I think people have to have stories. They tell stories naturally because we're all trying to sort out the struggles in our world, starting with ourselves. So it's good. That's what the point I think both Jake and I are trying to make here in our interestingly dialectical way is that you will spew these characters out and they will start making choices and you won't always know why. And then as you really begin to, you are in the audience's position with that. Why are they doing this? What is it? Where am I taking everybody? Why do I not know? That's because there's a hidden aspect of you that's trying to sort itself out in the storytelling. And insofar as you're trying to probe the mystery of the self, you're creating characters that are that much richer, that much more like real people.
Yeah. We have only probably about 7 more minutes to talk, and then we should do our writing exercise. So, Steve, if there was one more really important thing that you wanted to hit, what would it be?
there's a hole in the soul in our world in a lot of ways. There's a real loss of meaning that explains the suicide rate maybe among the French, and it explains perhaps the suicide rate among young kids now. It explains it in the world of engineering, where it's up through the roof because people are terrified of AI, because AI can solve the problem faster and better than you can. That hole in the soul is something that I think modern people, after World War II and after the sort of death of God, as they say, has left a spiritual size hole in all lives. So it is incumbent upon us to come to terms with our lives and the lives of others on a new level than we ever have before. So I don't know if I have another big sweeping thing to add, except that you need to find out who you are at depth and know that your characters are symptoms and products and beautiful manifestations of who you are, and not disconnect the two. You can take your characters as a way to exile them from you so they're not a problem for you. But if you remain in that dynamic relationship with them, you can't really do that and have an interesting character. You have to be in sort of mortal dialogue with them. Why do they exist? Who are they? Who are they manifesting? Is it 8 friends who I've lost over the years who are returning to me in the form of Joey the card shark? What are they doing here? Why have they entered my life? And make sure that you keep your divergent thinking open as long as you can and treat them as though they're here to tell you something about yourself, first and foremost. Because if that dynamism can remain through the whole process of discovery that you're in, the audience's process of discovery will be so rich that you won't believe you made it. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful, Steve. And one of the things that I love about having Steve on Thursday Night Rides and just having him on our fact, he's going to throw 50,000 like incredibly deep, complex ideas at you in 3 sentences. But he's also always got that simple thread that you can follow. And remembering like all these thoughts are so important. And at the center of it, what is Steve really saying? Go inside. It's all in you. All of these concepts are just tools to go, what is that hole in my soul? And how do I look at it? It doesn't have to be a black hole. It can be a shimmering sun. How do I look at that? Oh. Of course we make stuff up, but really, we use fiction to tell the truth. If we are totally making stuff up, what ends up happening is we feel completely unmoored, because it's like building a house of cards. If you got no solid foundation underneath it of this is real, this is true, then every choice is just craft. And your craft has to be so good that you can trick yourself and other people into believing it. But when you remember that every character already exists in you, their internal conflicts actually exist inside of you already. They're your internal conflicts, or they're a version of it, or they're your internal conflicts inside out. Jung talks about the shadow self. You might be writing a character who's an expression of your shadow, an unexpressed part of you. You might be writing a character whose people think of shadows as always dark, but they're not always, right? Your shadow might be your trust. Your shadow might be your love. Your shadow might be your faith. Your shadow might be your courage. When we get in touch with those pieces of ourselves and we actually write from there, we expand who we are. And we're doing 3 things at the same time every single time we write. We're expanding who the character is. We're expanding who we are. And we're expanding who the audience is. We're actually taking that hole in the soul and we're bringing it out into the light. And for me, that's what makes this process so exciting. You're getting in touch with stuff that you didn't know you had inside of you.
Yep. Journey of self-discovery comes creative products that are byproducts of your own wrestling match with yourself until you refine them, and then they can step away and live off the respirator, so to speak.
It's an amazing moment when the little bird leaves the nest and they're creating themselves.
They can walk on their own. That's craft, making them able to walk on their own, right?
So, Steve, would you like to walk them through the exercise?
Yeah, I'm going to challenge you all to go to one of your favorite characters that you have created and take on the voice of an internal antagonist within them, some aspect of this character who is an obstacle to their growth, to their intentions. I want you to use the first person, I, to tell us who they are and how they tend to undermine their character's life, what their tactic sort of is, and how it really works well when I do this to Joey or whatever. Remember that your internal antagonists may not be that extreme. They're probably not pathological, though they might be. In whichever case, they have a very specific relationship to the character. So I just want you to try to express that in one way or another, as if you were them, as if they were already characters unto themselves.
So you're writing a monologue from the point of view of your character's inner antagonist. Or
one of them, because they're usually... Yes. Yeah.
Yes. Have a lot of fun with it. You've got 7 minutes, so write nonstop. Whatever comes out is the right